So first of all, let us thank our sponsors for tonight. I just mentioned them between Mincha and Maariv. The Stebbinses, I think that's how you would say that. The Stebbinses are sponsoring tonight's Beit Midrash Learning in honor of their son's upsharon. You might be thinking, what does that mean, their son's upsharon? Their youngest boy is now in Eretz Yisrael learning in yeshiva. So it's a reference to Mikey. Mikey just had his first haircut in 3 years, and they are calling it an upsharon. I told them to see if he knows his Hebrew letters, but they didn't want to do that part. So, Baruch Hashem for the Stebbinses for sponsoring. Thank you. And Mazel Tov on the Chalaka, as they call it in Hebrew. Tonight, we're talking about a very, very, I don't know if it can get more influential than this, a very influential rabbi, legend in Jewish history, and that is none other than Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, also known as Rashi. Now, Rashi is obviously someone who everyone is at least familiar with the name, but let's learn a little bit about some of the background. And we'll see a little bit better, get a better appreciation for who Rashi was in terms of his contribution, but also in terms of his life. Because his influence does not simply stop with what he does in his life. It obviously continues throughout history until today. And we'll see in more ways than one. So let's start with Rashi's father. Now, the way we'll talk about Rashi's father is through his name. Because as we know, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, his last name was not Yitzchaki. In the 11th century, they didn't really have last names. So why was he called Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki? It would be if, for instance, someone, my kids would be known by me somehow. They would say, oh, there goes the Shayas, right? Because I am, you know, their father. So they're the Shaya kids, right? So, or the rabbi's kids, right? So in the same way, Rabbi Shlomo is known under unknown by his father. Happens to be that he was an only child, so it's kind of interesting that he's sort of the legacy of his father Yitzchak. Now, just to be clear, there is a little bit of discussion whether or not his actual father's name was Yitzchak, whether Rashi is an acronym for something else. There is a reference apparently in the introduction to maybe his Parish on Torah, which talks about how he's Rabbi Shlomo ben Yitzchak, but some say that there are other manuscripts that don't have the ben Yitzchak there, so there's somewhat of a discussion. But the general consensus or the general conventional wisdom says that his father's name was Yitzchak, and that's why he's known as Rashi. For those who say his father's name was not Yitzchak, and it does not stand for Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki, so they say that Rashi stands for something else. So I don't know if you want to take any guesses, but one of them is Rabban Shel Yisrael, Reish Shin Yud, Rabban Shel Yisrael, the Rabbi of Israel, which would certainly be a fitting title given his contribution to the Jewish people. And there are other ones as well in terms of how to understand the acronym. So his father Yitzchak, let's assume his father was Yitzchak, as conventional wisdom would say. His father was Yitzchak, his mother's brother was a rabbi in Mainz. So, in general, it would seem like he comes from a pretty established rabbinic family. On his mother's side, there were rabbis, and on his father's side, his father was a rabbi. And now, back then, rabbi doesn't necessarily mean that that's what you do full-time, but he learned from his father early on when he was a child. Unfortunately, his father passes away. Yitzchak passes away when Rashi is still a child. There are also some interesting legends about Rashi's birth. Some say that Yitzchak, his father, was actually a poor winemaker, a vintner, as they call them, and he one day found some precious jewels, and some non-Jews offered to buy the jewels so that they can put them on some Avodah Zarah, and it turns out that on the way, Rabbi Yitzchak threw the jewels into the river, and they were gone forever, so that they couldn't use them for Avodah Zarah. And in the schus of that, even though he and his wife were barren for many years, they were able to have a child, and that became Rashi. That's the story, at least. Story also goes that until he was five, he learned with his father, and then his father died while he was still young. So Rashi, at the age of 14, goes to Mainz. Now, just a little bit of Jewish geography and some maybe history also. At the time in the 11th century, there was such a thing as Ashkenazic Jewry, but it was very contained. So we're talking about basically German cities that are also close to France. And Rashi is born in northern France in a place called Troyes or Champagne. Yes, like the beverage Champagne. And he ultimately moved. He doesn't go so far. The Ashkenazic Jewish communities were relatively close to each other for that time period. And he goes over to Germany, over the border to Germany. There's a place sort of in between. We're not going to get to talk about it now. Rashi goes to Germany to join what's known as the Kehilot Shum. The Kehilot Shum is basically the congregation of Shum. We've talked about it a couple times. Shum stands for three communities, Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. Or in English, Speyer, Worms, and Mainz. So those three communities were basically the triumvirate of the Ashkenazic world. Now there obviously was a community in France where Rashi was from, but for the time, the center of Jewish of rabbinics was really these three communities. These were where the yeshivas were. If you wanted to be a learner, so you would go to these yeshivas. And it just so happens to be that Rashi's mother's brother was a rabbi in Mainz. So Shimon Hazaken he was known, and Reb Shimon Hazaken himself was a student of a very prominent rabbi from the previous generation, possibly century also, named Rabbeinu Gershom. Rabbeinu Gershom was very influential in terms of how he controlled Jewish communities. He was known as Rabbeinu Gershom Maor Hagola. He was the light of the entire exile. People might be familiar with his takanos. The takanos to Rabbeinu Gershom were things that tried to sort of leverage communal power to ensure people did certain things. So, for instance, there was a concept to not marry multiple wives. I believe that was in his, even though it was already established. A lot of the takanos were really just adding leverage to things that were already established. But certain things like not marrying more wives, not reading other people's mail is a famous one. Not interrupting davening or allowing somebody to interrupt in a certain type of davening. It depends how you look at it. So Rabbeinu Gershom was very influential in terms of the Jewish world. He had set these out, and to the extent that some people say that that his takanos are binding on all future generations. Some people say he said it for 1,000 years. Some people say he said it for more. Either way, takanos Rabbeinu Gershom is something we still follow today. We still are familiar with today. Much of it, by the way, comes from the fact that people had to travel in between communities. If you were going out away on business, you wouldn't just take a plane and come back a few days later. You would go for months, if not years at a time. And the fact that you wouldn't reported on, no one knows where you are or what you're doing for a long time, means you could establish an entirely new family in the other place that you lived. You could, and similarly in terms of sending letters back and forth, so he had to issue a decree to not read other people's mail because that's what used to happen. The letters would take months to get from a place A to place B, and the messengers would oftentimes read the mail. So what was the leverage that I'm talking about that they would use as a mechanism to make sure people would adhere to these? It's what they would call a cherem. Nowadays you have the word cherem, but it's more of a colloquialism or it's just sort of like a threat, but it's very difficult to enforce. Back then, if you think about it, so being part of a Jewish community is the entirety of your life. You can't just pick up and move to another community. Sometimes there weren't other communities to move to. And beyond that, your entire family, your extended family, probably lived in the same community that you did. So to be excommunicated, to get a cherem, was a big deal. It meant never seeing your family again. It meant never, seeing your house again. It really was a very big deal. So that was Takanos Rabbeinu Gershom. He was very influential. His student, Reb Shimon, was Rashi's uncle. And it just so happens that Rashi basically follows the follows the path of his grand Rebbe, and he too becomes, in many ways, the leader of the Jewish people. Now, he's learning in yeshiva for a few years in Mainz by his uncle, and then he marries Rivka. Not really sure who Rivka was, too much about her at least. But then after he learned with Worm in Mainz, he goes to learn in Worms. It's unclear exactly if that means that he went with Rivka, or did he travel there and go back and forth to see Rivka. I have here in my notes that it could be that he only saw Rivka 3 times a year for a different regalim, which would be obviously very out of the ordinary from what we're familiar with. At the same time, he was only 17 years old. So maybe he was dorming, maybe he wasn't traveling too much because he had to still study, he was too young to become a prominent rabbi yet. Either way, he learns by a Rebbe whose name is Rebbe Yaakov Ben Yakar, who was a relative of the rabbi of the community. Okay, so Rashi is really learning by the leaders of the Jewish people, at least the Ashkenazic world. He has his uncle was the rabbi of Mainz. His Rebbe's cousin was the rabbi of Worms. The only one he hasn't really touched with is Speyer. But either way, he learns in that yeshiva for about 8 years, and at the age of 25, he comes back to Troy, and his mother passes away. Unclear what order that happened in. But either way, he settles down in Troy, back to where he was born, in Champaign. And he ends up becoming part of the Beis Din. He's 25 years old, remind you. And he's part of the Beis Din. He starts writing tshuvas. At this point already, he starts writing tshuvas. And the Av Beis Din, shortly thereafter, passes away. And he basically becomes the Av Beis Din. Right? So he now is the chief rabbi. Before the age of 30, he's the chief rabbi of an entire Ashkenazic community known as Troy. You thought I was young. What does he do in Troy? He opens up a yeshiva. He opens up a yeshiva like any great chief rabbi would do in a place where there wasn't a yeshiva. He opens up a yeshiva, and even though he was already prominent in his rabbinic studies, meaning that he was the Av Beis Din, he was the head, the chief rabbi of Troy, and now he was a Rosh Yeshiva, the head rabbi of the seminary. Even though that was the case, legend has it that he did not take any money for either of those positions. The biggest rabbi in France, the biggest Ashkenazic rabbi in France, and he did not take any money. How did he make his money? So as you might think, as you might be aware, or maybe you have an assumption about, Rashi made wine. At least that's how the story goes. We do not have any profound evidence of this. What we do have evidence of is that Rashi is very well versed in the winemaking process, based on his commentaries in Shabbos and other places about what it means to make wine. So through those context clues, people surmise that maybe, and the fact that his father was a vintner, and the fact that he lived in Champagne, so all of these things add up to the fact that maybe Rashi was a winemaker. The truth is, we don't know for sure, but that's probably what fed the fact that there's a wine now called Rashi wine, right? That's probably based on that. But either way, that's presumably how he made his money. So this is presumably where Rashi lived. There's somewhat of a discussion if Rashi stayed the whole time. Did he move around and stuff? But generally, it's assumed that he stayed in northern France, and he did not go back to Kehilot Shum. He might have went back to visit or something like that, but he generally stayed in northern France. And the reason that's important is because Rashi was born in 1040, right? So he sets up his yeshiva in 1070. Shortly thereafter, as unfortunately we know, the Crusades hit Ashkenazic Jewry. And predominantly, the Crusades decimate not Troy, not northern France, but they decimate the Ashkenazic community in Germany. Specifically, Speyer, Worms, and Mainz, and many of Rashi's cousins, Rashi's friends, Rashi's Rebbeim, pass away in those unfortunate crusades, which we read about on Tisha B'Av. As I oftentimes point out, in order to understand the enormity of that event, you have to really imagine in your mind, Rashi learned from all these other rabbis. Imagine if we would have the works of all those other rabbis that Rashi learned from, how much more Torah we could know. Rashi, who's obviously learned every single day, poured over through all yeshivas around the world, no matter what they're learning. So imagine all the other Rashis we could have had if it wasn't for those crusades. Why is it that northern France was spared? So some actually attribute it to Rashi himself. Rashi had a good relationship with the local government, and because of that relationship, he was spared, and the entire community was spared from these crusades. I don't exactly know how they stopped them, but either way, he was spared. So when we think of Rashi, oftentimes we think of his commentary. Let's actually go to the commentary later. Let's talk a little bit about his family. As we know, Rashi, if anyone ever tells you that they're a descendant of Rashi, you know for a fact that it's not through the sons. It cannot possibly be Ben Achar Ben, as we call it, because Rashi only had daughters. He had two, possibly three daughters, somewhat of a legendary third daughter named Rachel. We don't know much about, but she was married and divorced from a man possibly named Eliezer. I believe there's like a reference to it in maybe one of the tshuvas or a letter that he wrote. I forget exactly right now. But he has two daughters. One of them's name is Yocheved, and the other's name is Miriam. Now, the first, let's do Miriam. She's a little less known in terms of her descendants. Miriam marries a man named Rabbi Yehuda ben Nasan. If anyone is familiar with the Tosafist, so you might know Rabbi Yehuda ben Nasan as the Rivan. The Rivan is not very often quoted, but he is in Tosfos. He is quoted sometimes. I believe we quoted him once in a Kasha on the Week early on. I think, I'm not 100% sure. It was either the Rivar or the Rivan. But either way, so Rabbi Yehuda ben Nasan, that's the son-in-law of Rashi. And they have four kids, Alvina, I think is the girl, and then they have three other kids. One's name was Yom Tov, then there was Shimshon, and then there was Eliezer. I'm not familiar with any of their acronyms. It doesn't seem like there are, I mean, I don't know of any. They actually move away to Paris. Now, in Paris, we do find some of Tosafists there. But it's a few and far between that there are some Tosafists, but they presumably come from Rashi's grandchildren through Rabbi Yehuda ben Nasan. They are much less known. But the legend has it that the Rivan that I spoke about actually finished Rashi's commentary on Makos, which we'll talk about his commentaries soon. More well known are the daughters of the children of his older daughter Yocheved. Yocheved marries a man named Meir ben Shmuel. And Meir becomes basically the last letter in many Tosafists' names. Because what you have is his oldest, his name is Shmuel, right? Meir's father's name was Shmuel. Their firstborn, Shmuel, is named after his grandfather. In 1080, and he's known more as the Rashbam. Rashbam is also famous for following Rashi's footsteps in many ways, making a commentary on the Gemara and also a commentary on the Chumash. So that's the Rashbam, Rav Shmuel ben Meir. And then we have the next brother is born in 1090, whose name was Yitzchak. He's known as the Rivam, with a mem at the end. Also, Rabbi Yitzchak ben Meir. More of a Tosafist, not a commentary like his father, like his grandfather. And then we have a possible other son named Shlomo, who might have died early. And then we have perhaps Rashi's greatest, or Rashi's most famous, most well-known son, and that is Yaakov. Rabbi Yaakov ben Meir. What was Rav Yaakov ben Meir's acronym? It was not Rivam, because his older brother was already the Rivam. Instead, Rav Yaakov ben Meir is mostly known as Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam, why is he named Rabbeinu Tam? Because his name was Yaakov. And Rav Yaakov is named for the original Yaakov. Yaakov Ish Tam Yoshev Ohalim. He was a simple or complete son. He would sit in the tents. And that's why the third son, or maybe the fourth son, of Yocheved and Meir was named Rabbeinu Tam, or we know him as Rabbeinu Tam, because even though his name was Yaakov, he couldn't use the acronym Rivam because his brother already took it. So instead, he used the acronym, or the moniker, I guess, Rabbeinu Tam. There are other possible reasons for why his name was Rabbeinu Tam. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Rabbeinu Tam was our first Legends and Lessons class when we started this class a year ago. So if you want, you can look up on YU Torah. You can listen to that class again, because his Yahrzeit site is in a couple days from now. Rashi's Yahrzeit site is not till the end of the month, but still in Tammuz nonetheless. They did have a daughter, Chana, who apparently, the legend has it, taught halacha to women. That's what they say. Chana taught halacha to women. I've always wanted to learn more about her, but I don't think we have much in terms of evidence. So if anyone ever finds some research about Chana, the granddaughter of Rashi, I would be very intrigued to learn more about her. But that's the legend. She marries a man named Shmuel ben Simcha, and their son is known as the Ri. So anytime you see the Ri in Tosfos, so you know he's the great grandson of Rashi, the son of Chana and Shmuel. As I said before, there might be a third child named Rachel. We don't know much about her. So transitioning now from the family into Rashi's commentary. We know, and this is where much of the discussion comes about Rashi's daughters, right? Everyone wants to know, did Rashi's daughters wear tefillin? So to make it clear, there is absolutely no proof that Rashi's daughters wore tefillin. It's a very interesting legend. It might be based off of Gemaras that imply that there are other women who wore tefillin. There's no proof that Rashi's daughters wore tefillin. However, there is substantial proof that Rashi's daughters were very instrumental in Rashi's manuscripts. On the one hand, they helped him transcribe many of the things, especially when Rashi got older, up in his age, so then he couldn't write anymore. It was difficult for him to write. And his daughters actually wrote out much of his commentary, and including his responses, his tshuvas. And legend has it that sometimes they would actually contribute to the tshuvas themselves. It is pretty clear that Rashi definitely learned with his daughters the most in-depth of texts. If they're the ones that are actually helping him read, write and discuss tshuvas and commentaries on the Gemara and on the Chumash, so clearly they were well-learned women. It's very interesting to point out, not only because they're women, but also because the general population at the time was not very literate. Right, France is, as we said before, wasn't bustling with yeshivas. It wasn't this well-educated city. Rashi, at the time, much of the general population was illiterate. So for Rashi to not only have his family be literate, but even his daughters be literate, was probably unheard of. I would say he was probably 1,000 years before his time in terms of teaching women, maybe 900 years before his time, until Sarah Schneer really made a big point of it in was it Krakow? So that's the legend of Rashi's daughters. Not tefillin, but very well learned exceptionally well learned for women at the time. So what did Rashi do? How did Rashi come up with his commentary? So the truth is that Rashi started his commentary as a student. We mentioned before that in his early 20s, he was a student in the Kehilot Shum, specifically in Worms, after he got married to Rivka. And in the yeshiva, he would, apparently, this is the story goes, and those who are familiar with this phrase will now understand where it comes from. Rashi in the yeshiva used to listen to the Gemara lectures, and he used to write his own commentary, and he used to slip it into the Rebbe's desk. This is the legend. He used to slip it into the Rebbe's desk, but he never, ever put his name on it. And that's why Rashi is known as Kuntres. Kuntres literally means like a pamphlet, or like there are other words for a booklet of some kind, a treatise. The Kuntres is how Rashi's grandchildren refer to Rashi. Now, I'm not sure, and I'd be interested to hear this also, I'm not sure if they were doing that because they knew his grandfather didn't want the praise, or because it was an ode to his humility, or because literally they didn't know. I think it would probably be very difficult to say that they didn't know that the Kuntres was his grandfather, but any time the Tosafists, which are a conglomerate of Rashi's grandchildren, ever comment on Rashi, they never say Rashi. They never say he's our grandfather. They always say Kuntres. They always call him the Kuntres. This is presumably in some way based on the fact that when he originally wrote his commentary on the Gemara, it was done anonymously, and that's why they just called it the pamphlet. That pamphlet that always just appeared in Shir.
Rabbi, what is a kuntres?
A kuntres literally means a pamphlet or a treatise. Oh, okay. It's like a pad of notes, basically.
Gotcha.
So it's what language is that? Kuntres. Is that Hebrew?
There's two books to Tanya that are all kuntres.
Is that Aramaic? Maybe it's
different
Aramaic.
Letters.
It doesn't sound like a Hebrew word to me. It doesn't ring as a Hebrew word to me. But it could be now. Maybe it could be now. I don't know. Kuntres. It sounds more like Aramaic or maybe even French. I don't know. Either way. So as we said, Rashi writes his commentary on Gemara that way. He writes his tshuvas mainly when he becomes the chief rabbi of Troy, and he becomes part of the Beis Din and gets involved there. And then he writes his commentary on Chumash as he goes, I think, back in Troy. I'm not sure if he wrote those also in Germany. But either way, Rashi ultimately writes a commentary on every single book of Gemara, every single book of Mishnah. Well, if he writes it, he ran out of time. We lost some of them. There are some things that we don't have Rashi's commentary on. But one could assume that Rashi went through all of all Tanakh with a commentary. And we also have Rashi on almost all Gemara. So the amount of writing that Rashi does is just astounding, the amount that he accomplished. But even more important or more influential is not just the fact that he has a commentary, but the nature of the commentary. Because what Rashi does, some would call him the great synthesizer. Rashi, in the beginning of Bereishis, or towards the beginning of Bereishis, tells us what his point of writing the Parish is. He tells us, this is what he tells us, his purpose in writing the commentary is to tell us the pshat, is to tell us the simplest understanding of the psukim. The way to understand it, simply, literally, without getting too in-depth. Now, the great irony of that is that Rashi almost always, in order to do that, in order to actually tell us the literal, simple understanding of the Pesukim, he tells us all the Midrashim, right? Rashi very rarely gives us a commentary, at least a narrative commentary, without getting it already from a Midrash. So anytime you hear someone explain a story and they say, Rashi says, the truth is Rashi didn't say it. Now, oftentimes, Rashi will quote a Midrash in a different way than we have it, which means that he is already using his own lens to understand the Midrash and apply it to the Pasuk, but nonetheless, he's quoting a Midrash. And it's always very interesting. I love doing this, and sometimes it's not a great forum to do so. It's always interesting to look at Rashi's understanding of the Midrash or his quoting of the Midrash and see how it is that he differed. He purposefully changed sort of analyzed the Midrash in order to apply it to the Pasuk, whereas you could analyze it otherwise. But either way, for the Pesukim, for the Chumash, he basically creates an understanding of Pshat, which is infused with Rabbinic Mesorah, with the Midrashim that he finds most relevant to understand the Pasuk. And that's important because almost all of the stories we know about, or I wouldn't say all the stories, obviously it's not true, but almost all of the details that we know about certain stories in the Chumash, even specifically in Bereishis, are almost all based on Rashi. Rashi could have easily quoted other Midrashim. He could have easily made, for the rest of Jewish history, he could have made a different narrative about certain stories in Tanakh, and instead he used a specific Midrashim that caused us to understand it in the way that we do. I'm trying to think of a quick example here. Let's see, quick example of, I'm sure there's some good, we'll see some in this week's Parsha. We'll see some soon in this week's Parsha on Korach. And then he also learns Gemara. Gemara is sometimes very tricky. You know, if anyone's ever tried to learn Gemara, and they've opened up, let's look at the Gemara for a second. This is Gemara in Shabbos that we've been doing in Daf Yomi. You look at this Gemara. So what do you see? You see a bunch of little words, and they don't have any punctuation marks. There's no punctuation, there's no comma, there's no period, there's no question mark. And basically, what Rashi comes along and says is, this is a question, He tells us, this is a question. Oftentimes he'll tell us, this is an answer. If it's not clear, if you don't understand how the Gemara talks, and you don't understand, even if you do understand, sometimes it gets complicated. Rashi comes along to tell us how to understand the Gemara, and how to interpret the problem with the Gemara. So even today, if anyone's in the halacha, the daily halacha, WhatsApp, so you'll notice that when I explained the Gemara, I said specifically, this is according to Rashi. Because every time you open up a Gemara, and you understand the Gemara, there's conversation, and then there's the underneath conversation that's running beneath the Gemara. Why is it that the Gemara tells us you have to wash your hands in the morning? Rashi comes along, sort of grafting a different Gemara in another place, brings it over to this Gemara and says it's because of something called Ruach Ra. And that becomes the simple way to understand the Gemara, because that's how Rashi understood the Gemara. And many times you'll hear, rabbis tell, their students, try to figure it out without Rashi, right? Because Rashi makes it so understandable. Rashi makes it so easily, digestible to understand. Just like Rashi, oftentimes it's like candy. It's too easy to digest. You don't have to think for yourself. So, they used to say, how did Rashi figure it out, right? How did Rashi learn without Rashi? Right? Presumably, Rashi had to think about it for a long time in order to understand it. So too, when we learn the Gemara, we always have to first try to figure it out ourselves, and then we go to our helpful friend Rashi, who always has something to say. Somehow Rashi always knows when we don't understand something. It's one of the great blessings of understanding Rashi and his brilliance, is that if you ever find, and you have to obviously get to a certain basic level of understanding Gemara, and how it works, but whenever you're looking for greater understanding of a Gemara, almost always Rashi is going to be there to help you understand it. And it happens for those of you, let's see, we've got Evan here, we've got Michael and Leonard. So for those of you doing Daf Yomi with us, you'll notice that oftentimes when we're going through a Daf and someone asks a question, it's like, well, Rashi probably says it. And I just didn't look at Rashi for every single, I oftentimes just try to get through the Gemara and I don't look at, even the basic understanding with Rashi, which is my own fault. But nonetheless, Rashi is always there, to figure it out for us. Our visitor today. Come here, buddy. You want to say hi?
Hi.
Hi. Say hi. Yeah, there he is. We need a haircut. Speaking of upsharing, he's had plenty of haircuts and he's not even two. Either way, so this is not a time to talk about the roots, pun intended, of upsharings, but it's not our family minhag. Either way, so Rashi, ultimately, as we said before, is saved from the Crusades because of his relationship with the bishop in Troy. But he obviously knows many people, unfortunately, perished, at least in that first crusade. He passed away before some of the other crusades, but in 1096, he was very intimately aware of the death of many of his close friends, relatives, colleagues, rabbis, and he actually mourned them and wrote many of the piyutim, the slichos, that we still have today. I don't think we use many of them, but we do have those still. So, let's see. So one of the interesting situations that Rashi had to deal with as the leader of the Jewish people in the aftermath of the Crusades was many questions of Christianity. Because as we know, the Crusades were not just killing people, they were also forcefully converting people. And when they were forcefully converting people, so there are a lot of shilas with that. And the questions come up, this person's claiming he's Jewish, that he was forcefully converted. How do I know if he's true or not? And Rashi famously tells us, basically quoting from the Gemara, that if somebody thinks that he's Jewish, at least according, if there's justifiable reason for such a thing, so then give it to mommy. So then he tells us, Yisrael afal pishachata Yisrael hu, even if a Jewish person sins, he's still a Jewish person. Right? That's what Rashi invokes, at least famously that's what he said. And therefore he says that you have to believe these people who say that they were captured and converting by Christians. For many years, Rashi passes away on the 29th of Tammuz. Usher, we have to be a little quieter because Abba's trying to learn. Rashi passes away on the 29th of Tammuz in 1105. He was born in 1040 and died in 1105. As a joke I've said before from a Rebbe of mine, perhaps the most influential 25 minutes of history, 1040 to 1105, Rashi's life. Either way, Rashi was buried somewhere. We didn't know where until many years later. Apparently, a document had surfaced, and again, because of the Crusades, the city was not really well kept for the Jews, and we didn't figure out that he was actually buried in a courtyard in Troy until much later. And nowadays, you can actually see a monument there. It's very sort of like artistic. It's like a big ball, and it says Rashi. His commentary became obviously the basic understanding of Gemara and of Chumash. And almost immediately, by the way, the first printed Chumashim was with Rashi's commentary. Obviously, there's the Gutenberg Bible, which is not necessarily our type of Bible, but I believe, if I'm not mistaken, the first Chumash that was printed with Rashi's commentary. And basically, for all Chumashim for the rest of Jewish history, they were printed with Rashi's commentary. Very few Chumashim nowadays you can even find without a Rashi's commentary. So it's just a testament to how basic it is to understanding Rashi. There are over 200 super commentaries on Rashi, meaning commentaries trying to figure out what Rashi means. Why did Rashi say this? What was Rashi's implicit question when he said this? So much of rabbinic discourse is based on Rashi's commentary too. As I said before, he's a blend of drash and pshat based on the midrash to understand the Torah. There are those who say, explicitly, specifically his grandson, the Rashbam, who say that Rashi, when he was older and no longer able to revise his commentary, actually would have made it even simpler. Rashi, as we said, was trying to make it simple, and he thought, the Rashbam claims, in later on in Bereishis, says, I spoke to my grandfather, and my grandfather told me that if he was able to, he would make it even simpler. And that's why the Rashbam is much more of a Pashtan than Rashi. The Rashbam does not include a lot of Midrash. He almost always gives the explanation, which is more literal, which is more simplistic, understanding just the words of the Torah, without incorporating the Mesorah of Chazal. Presumably, he couldn't have done that for so long, because the Rashbam was born in 1080, which means that Rashi passed away when he was 25. But nonetheless, he was able to learn from his grandfather, Baruch Hashem, for that relationship too. So that's Rashi in sort of his life, in the gist of it at least. Obviously, you can never really capture the life of Rashi in 45 minutes. But just to sort of to understand how this sort of persona comes out in terms of him being a synthesizer between the Pshat and the Drash. So let's look at perhaps the most famous Rashi on this week's Parsha. Why is it? If I would ask you this question, those who learned Korach in day school, the truth is at this point we might be in the summer months where nobody knows anything about the Parshas because they didn't learn them in day school. But let's assume for a moment that some of you were in day school for the Parshas Korach. So if I were to ask you, what was the story behind Korach? What were the questions that Korach asked? Why was it that Korach wanted to take over? So if you look in the Pesukim, you won't find anything. You'll see how Korach talks about how he's so holy, just like he could be as holy as Moshe and Aaron. Why would they be more holy? But it doesn't really give us an argument. So Rashi brings us perhaps the most famous reason, and there are also, by the way, interesting deviations within this Rashi from the Midrash that people pick up on and darshan, but we're not going to get into those. So Rashi tells us at the beginning of the Parsha, Umara Korach, what did Korach see lachloki Moshe to disagree with Moshe so much? Niskane on the seus shall Elitzafan ben Uziel, he was jealous of the position Elitzafan. Shemino Moshe Nasi, because Moshe made Elitzafan a Nasi on for the family of Kahas, because based on Hashem said that. So Umar Korach, Achi Abba Arba Hayu, my father's brothers were four. Shnemer of Nekas v'Gomer, it says Amram, Yitzhar, Chevron, and Uziel. So Amram Habachor, Natlu Shnei Banav Gedula. His two sons got greatness, right? They came to prominence, Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron HaKohen. All right, so Rashi says, Echad Melech, which is a reference to Moshe, ve'echad Kohen Gadol, and one of them was the Kohen Gadol. So Mirai Litoles Hashnia, who should take over the second princehood, I guess? Lo Ani, is it not me? She'ani Ben Yitzhar. I was the Shehu Shenu Amram. So fine, Moshe and Aaron get to be the firstborn's two children that grow to prominence, right? They were the children of Amram. He was the firstborn of Kahas, right? So they get to be the first, the two most prominent grandchildren of Levi. But the next son of Kahas was Yitzhar. So for Yitzhar, Korach is like, well, that means I'm next. And nonetheless, Korach didn't get anything special. Vuhu Mina Nasi. Moshe appointed somebody else. Shehu Sheni Le'amra Vuhu Mina Nasi as Ben Achiv HaKatan Mikulam. He appointed Elitzafan Ben Uziel. Uziel was the youngest son of Kahas. So Korach is thinking to himself, why don't I get the position of being the prince? I'm the firstborn of the secondborn to Kahas. So the Gemara, so the Rashi tells us, Hareni Cholek Alav Umevatlos Devarv. I'm going to disagree with him. I'm going to create a machlokas with Moshe Rabbeinu. And this is perhaps the most famous part. What was the machlokas Korach brought up with Moshe? So he says the following, so what did he do? Amad v'chanas masayim v'chamishim roshei Sanhedrios. He brought 250 people together. Ruban misheva Ruven shcheinav. Most of them came from Ruven. V'heim elitzor ben shteyur v'chaveirav. U'v'chayot zbeo shenemar nsiyei de kriya moed anshe shem. U'l'holon hu omer ele kriya oeda. V'l'bishan talisos. What did he do? He put tzitzis on all of them. Talises. They got a bunch of talises and they made them all techeles. They created techeles on all of the baggage, the actual cloth of the garment. They made them all techeles. They're all this indigo blue that we know of, right? Some of you might have it. So they made them all techeles. Bo v'amdul of Moshe. They all came in front of Moshe. And they said to him, Amru lo tal shekula shel techeles chayav besitzis o petura. A baggage, a garment which has only blue dye. It's entirely blue. Do you still have to put tzitzis on it? If the whole point of tzitzis is for that one tchelas string, so what if the entire baggage is blue with tchelas? Do you still have to put tzitzis on? This is what they ask Moshe. So Amar Lahem, he says back to them, Chayeves, you have to. Hischil lischok alav. They started to laugh at Moshe Rabbeinu. Efshar, tal shel min acher. Chut echad, tal shel min acher. If it was a different type of baggage, chut echad shel tchelas potra, and only one string is good enough to make it all good. Zu shekul tchilas. This entire thing is blue, and you're telling me it's still not good enough. One string is good enough, but the entire bag is not good enough. How could that be? And this is what Rashi quotes as the machlokas on Moshe Rabbeinu from Korach. This has become the most famous example of what Korach's machlokas is. It happens to be that Korach, according to the Midrash, has other examples, other questions that he asks about a room full of Sifrei Torah. Does it need a mezuzah? There's one more, I think. I can't remember it off the top of my head now. But either way, Korach asks other things according to the Midrash. Rashi only brings this one. And therefore, for the rest of Jewish history, people know this machlokas between Moshe and Korach that he asks about the tcheles. They don't know the other ones as well, unless you're listening to a rabbi who's giving a drasha about that. But nonetheless, this statement from Rashi is perhaps the most well known because specifically Rashi brought it down as opposed to other things. So that's sort of a little bit of a taste for what Rashi does. That was a medrash in the Tanchuma, which Rashi brings down and basically, pun intended, colors the conversation of the Torah. Even though the Torah simply says, why are you any holier than us? The truth is that he makes a much more specific argument according to Rashi. Now, does that mean that it's the only way to understand the Torah? No, but that's what you learn in day school because that's how Rashi explains it. And Rashi is trying to teach us the simplest, most basic way to understand the Torah. And that's why we oftentimes use Rashi as the basis for our understanding, because Rashi's whole point is to give us that basic understanding. So that's Rashi in a nutshell. Obviously, so much more to learn, so much more to understand about Rashi's life, but that's a little bit of the background of who Rashi was, Rabbi Shlomo Yitzchaki. presumably the son of Yitzchak, who had not only an influence in his own life, writing tshuvas, writing commentaries, but his grandchildren become the basis of not only what they did in their lives. Rabbeinu Tam was also, in many ways, the leader of the Jewish people, but also they become the basis for a lot of halacha. The commentary that they write on Rashi's commentary and other things on the Gemara basically become the basis of Ashkenazic psak. If anyone wants to know anything about how to be an Ashkenazi Jew, it's almost all through Rashi. Either Rashi or his grandchildren are all responsible for the creation of Ashkenazic halacha. So a lot to obviously to give kavod to Rashi and to really appreciate who he was and who he continues to influence everything, how he continues to influence everything we do today. Much of what we do, all the way down to our tefillin, is Rashi tefillin. Doesn't matter what kind of tefillin it is through Rashi, because the other type is Rabbeinu Tam tefillin. But either way, so a lot to learn, obviously, about Rashi, a lot more to learn from Rashi. And Amir Tzashem, now you have a little bit of a better picture of who this legend of Jewish history was, and a little bit of what he did. Okay, thank you all for joining. And thank you for the Stebbinses again for sponsoring in honor of Mikey's upsharing. A little overdue, but he got it done either way. Okay, Shkayach everyone. I don't think Rashi gave an upsharing to his kids. I'm going to go out on a limb on that one.